To stay up to the budget for the rest of your life requires starting out with the right attitude. And we're going to talk about that some this morning. My own fundraising adventure began the day that I took my boss out to lunch at Lum's Restaurant in Iowa City. I told him I'd be quitting the newspaper to go into full-time Christian service. He said, well, how's that going to work out financially? I said, not to worry, the Lord will provide. He seemed a bit skeptical. I was a bit skeptical myself. 2 weeks later, the office gang sponsored a going-away party for me. They presented me with a huge plaque in the shape of a penny. And the inscription read, "In God we trust. All others, strictly cash." And so it began. My first fundraising appointment was at the home of two elderly ladies from our former church back in Ames. I knew they'd be glad to see me, and I was eager to talk to them. I got to the house, and I noticed they had blue hair, and they had aged some since I had seen them last. I noticed that the house was really run down. The carpet was worn, the furniture was dilapidated, but as I started going through my presentation book, they were enthusiastic about it, and we were having a good time. As I got closer to the last page, which of course is where the money part is, I began to get a little nervous, began to get a little edgy, couldn't concentrate. I couldn't remember if I had told these ladies that I would be saying anything about money. Well, I began to stall, and a voice inside me said, "Scott, you can't ask these ladies for money. Look at that sofa. Look at that carpet. Look at this house. You're better off than they are. Don't you dare turn the last page." But then another voice inside me said, "Scott, you quit your job. You can't support your family on what you've got right now. Go ahead. Turn the last page." Then the other voice came back and said, "Oh, no, you don't, you devourer of widows' houses." And so the argument went back and forth all the way through the book until I got to the last page, which I did not turn. I asked the ladies for prayer. I did not ask them for support. Finally, they asked me a question. They said, "Scott, would you like some cookies?" I said, "Yes, I'd love some cookies." And so we had a time of fellowship, and I left wondering if I should try to get my job back at the newspaper. Now, this scene was repeated several times. I wanted to make my needs known, but I felt guilty doing it. Now, I got a lot of suggestions from other people. One staff told me, "Money follows ministry." And I'd heard that before. The people that I was ministering to were supposed to support me. But our work was primarily evangelism. I couldn't ask non-Christians or brand new Christians to support me. Former ministries, well, we'd had some success, but not very much, and we didn't have many people to go to. A pastor in Cedar Rapids said, "Scott, don't ask people to give. Just ask them to pray. They'll kind of get the idea." I call that the osmosis method. Then I'd hope the people on our mailing list would give. We sent out a letter, but we didn't ask for financial help. We asked for people to pray for our finances. And I'm sure some of them are still praying. Now, some people promised to give but never did. And sometimes large gifts came from strangers. But most of the time, I felt wrong trying to raise money at all. I criticized myself, saying, "Why can't I be like George Mueller or Hudson Taylor, who saw thousands of dollars pour in through prayer alone?" Somehow, I felt that if I could just stick with it long enough, the money would start to trickle in after a few years. Then a staff member suggested, "Scott, what you really need is a military ministry." Well, that was fine, except there's not a lot of military in Eastern Iowa. Another staff said, "Materials, sell lots of materials." Another said, "Christian businessmen, that's the answer." Great, except I didn't know any Christian businessmen, and I was scared to talk to him anyway. Ralph at Ralph's IGA seemed interested, but he never gave anything. Now, in the midst of all this frustration, God was abundantly blessing our ministry. Many were coming to Christ, many were being discipled, and fundraising began to take a back seat. In fact, I look at it as a necessary evil. Discipling was the real ministry, and fundraising was the castor oil of being a navigator. Once a month, I decided to do something about it, usually the day after our paycheck came. But the feeling went away. Now, I had told my boss at the newspaper that the Lord would provide. Did he? Well, yes, he did. We had a place to live. We had a clothing. We had food. But we also owed the navigators $1,800. Those were the days when you could overdraw your account a little bit each month, and I was good at that. And every month I'd do a little, and I kept thinking, next month the Lord will bring the money in, next month. But it never happened. I confess that I was irresponsible. My wife paid all the bills, handled all our finances. She was much better at it than I. But I had abdicated. She also felt all the pressure. I felt none. Giving? Well, we gave some, but not generously or consistently. In doing our taxes one year, I had noticed that for one mission organization we supported, instead of 12 receipts for monthly gifts, I found 7. The breakthrough came in 1973, and it started with a Bible study. We had scrimped along for 3.5 years at 60% of budget, and then 1 month our income soared. I felt terrible. Something was wrong. I felt guilty about it. And I realized then that I had a problem with fundraising, and I had a problem with God. I had a problem with grace. And so I sat down at our card table with a blank sheet of paper, turned to Philippians 4, and began a Bible study that's not done yet. That was a turning point. It was because of the Bible I saw that my attitudes were wrong. It was because of the Bible I realized that I was not a good steward. And it was because of the Bible I decided to do something about it. Well, I come to you as a fellow traveler. I've made the mistakes. I've experienced the frustration. I'm still learning. I still get butterflies when I pick up the phone to make a fundraising appointment. But I've come to see fundraising as a privilege rather than as a curse. What are some obstacles that we think of when we think of raising our personal support? I call this the no pastas syndrome, P-A-S-T-T-A-S. First of all, no potential givers. I've run out of people to talk to. I don't come from an evangelical background. I've got a small mailing list. If somebody would give me a bunch of names of some warm, friendly people, I'd certainly go call on them. Maybe the navigators would give me some names. What do I do now? No prospective givers. A stands for attitude. A veteran staff told me once, I literally get sick when I think of raising money to go back overseas. And some of us struggle with the questions of conscience, like, is it really right to make your needs known? I believe there are 3 major attitudes that we need to watch out for. The first is a get-by mentality. I picked up a hitchhiker once about midnight in rural Wisconsin. And I always ask hitchhikers this question. What is your major life goal? And my friend was slightly inebriated, and he said, my goal is to get by. And I confess that I once had that mentality. I never planned on being up to budget. We drifted along month by month, year by year, just barely getting the bills paid and kind of limping along, and I was satisfied. After a few years, this gets tiresome. And staff who are in this situation now are tempted to overuse credit cards. And there are staff who have tremendous debts because of that. A get-by mentality. Second attitude we need to be concerned about is fear. I sometimes wonder if our theological reasons for not raising support are really simply cover-ups for deep-down fears. Perhaps the fear of being rejected by people. I went round and round with one of our staff a few weeks ago, and he had all kinds of reservations about personal fundraising. And then finally, he made his first call. He loved it. It went great. Then he made 25 more calls in the Midwest later on. He loved every one of them. He doesn't have any theological problems with fundraising anymore. You know, in evangelism, when I was a young Christian, I had the same problem. I was convinced evangelism was theologically incorrect the way we were doing it, until I started doing it. And I loved it and changed my mind. If you're fearful, call it that. Don't substitute a theological reason for it. A third attitude is laziness. Oh, I hate to mention this, but I believe that we all fail to raise support at times for no other reason than simply lack of diligence. Fundraising is hard work. It takes energy, creativity, risk. And I find that I would rather do anything else. And so I find myself substituting good things, good activities, activities for which no one would criticize me, but the fundraising isn't getting done. And I know, and the Lord knows, it's simply laziness. P, potential givers. A, attitude. S, skills. You know, we believe that people will be more effective in evangelism if they just have a few skills. And the same is true in fundraising. Some staff don't get support, not because of attitude problems, not because they don't have people to talk to, but simply because they lack some skills. For example, they may ask for cash and monthly at the same time. That's simply a skills mistake. T, time. I just don't have time to raise funds. The ministry takes all my time. I'm expected to evangelize, establish, equip, run conferences, go to staff meetings, and now be at 100% of budget as well. How am I going to do all that? You can't add fundraising onto the top of an already too busy schedule. Something has to drop. And often fundraising is simply done during the vacation. A second T stands for a target-only mentality. Years ago, it was possible to spend 99% of your time in a target ministry and be supported 100% from that target ministry. That is, all the money would come right out of the target, especially in the military work. But that's not true today. Today, a staff member, especially a collegiate staff, can spend all of his time in a target ministry, like a college campus, but only get 10, 15, or 20% of his income right out of the target. And the same is becoming true of community and military ministries as well. We have to have both. We want to receive money from our target, but we also have to have a constituency outside our target of people who support us. It's not only necessary, it's a good idea. I'm not so sure that I'd want to be totally funded by the people in my ministry. We need both, constituency and target, and a target-only mentality will hinder us. A stands for accountability. What will happen if you're not up to 100% of budget? What are the navigators going to do to you? Well, are they going to release you? Are they going to break your fingers? Are they going to burn your house down? What are they going to do? I talked with a staff guy once who said, I said, do you think the navigators would ever impose a rule on you that you couldn't start your ministry in the fall until you were at 100% of budget? Do you think they'd ever impose such a rule on you? He thought about it a minute. Then he looked around the room to make sure there's no state directors in the room. And he says, no, I don't think they'd have the guts. Well, he found out. Who will hold you accountable in your fundraising? S stands for strategy. I suspect our yearly strategy is often 51 weeks of good intentions, followed by a fight with a wife or a fight with a roommate, and then 1 week of 18-hour days fundraising. For veteran staff, that's dangerous. You can't do that year after year. Otherwise, fundraising is nothing more than a crisis. Well, can you identify with some of these obstacles? Which ones are yours? Take a minute and think, is there one obstacle that's keeping me from being at 100% of budget? Not 80%, not 90%, but 100%. What would it be? Identify it and pray about it the next few days. Repeat it to the Lord in your devotional times. And let me encourage you to be honest enough to say to the Lord, you know, my main problem is that I'm just scared. Identify the people that you're afraid of. Maybe it's parents, what they would think. Maybe it's certain friends of yours that you fear their opinion if they were to know what you were doing. And let's name those fears for what they are. Now the next section deals with attitudes in raising personal support. So let's take our handouts and turn to the section on attitudes. A door-to-door salesman called at our home in Minneapolis. He had a polished presentation. He sold a good product. But I found myself resisting him, and I didn't buy anything. He thanked me and closed the door and left to go to the neighbors. I stared at the floor for about 10 seconds, trying to figure out what it was that bothered me about his presentation. Finally, I raced out the door, tracked him down, and stopped him before he got to my neighbor's house in the middle of the lawn. Well, he was surprised. And I said, excuse me, it wasn't your product. It was your attitude that turned me off. And I believe there's some Christian workers who have the mistaken idea that fundraising is simply knowing a few techniques, a few buzzwords, a few tricks of the trade, and that's all there is to it, and you're up to budget. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our attitudes, our values, our beliefs matter a great deal. The first belief that we need to have is that God is the source, not our donors, not our plans, not our hard work. God is our source. The Levites understood that God was the source. Listen to Numbers 18:24. For the tithe of the sons of Israel, which they offer as an offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites. Two phrases, which they offer to the Lord. And the second phrase, I have given to the Levites. The people offered the tithe to God. It was a vertical gift. And God gave the tithe back to the Levites. The offering of a lamb or a bundle of grain was not a horizontal gift from Israelite to Levite. It was a vertical gift from Israelite to God. And from God, it was another vertical gift to the Levite. I believe that Paul understood this. In Philippians 4:18, he said, he called the Philippians' gift a fragrant aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. Vertical. Furthermore, at the time God called the Levites, he also inaugurated their livelihood. The calling and the funding were taken care of at the same time. Can you imagine God overlooking the Levites' provisions? He called them for special service, cut them off from an income, no land, and now thinks, boy, I wish I'd remembered how we're going to fund those folks. Wish I'd have thought of that. Of course, the funding and the calling were taken care of at the same time. God provided a way. And I'd like to suggest that if God has called you for special service, He has already funded you. The money is already there. It's just a matter of your finding out who it is, who the participants are. That's an exciting task, not a drudgery. There's no shortage of money. You're already funded. 1 Chronicles 29:12 says, both riches and honor come from thee. David knew who the source was. But we tend to look at two other sources rather than the Lord. The first is people. I remember rushing home from work one day to open the mailbox, and I saw the brown envelope with the green edging on the side. The eagle had landed. And I tore into our paycheck and began reading the names of those who had given, and then feeling resentment toward the names that weren't there, that should have been there. Why aren't they giving? They said they'd give. Why aren't they giving? And those feelings of resentment told me that I was looking to people, not the Lord. A future staff man came to me for advice about 3 years ago, said, Scott, what am I going to do? Our pastor's made some mistakes, and I'm an elder, and I've got to go confront him. What am I going to do? I said, well, you've got to go talk to him. He said, well, it's not that simple. He says, the church has promised to support me for $200 to maybe $500 a month, and if I were to go to talk to the pastor, why, I might put that money in jeopardy. A week later, he confessed, came back to me, and he said, Scott, I've been looking at men, not God. Here's his quote. I've been so worried about minding my P's and Q's around the church so as not to offend them in order to get a lot of money. Let's look to God, not people. If people are your source of funding, that's a horizontal view. That's merely charity. There's nothing biblical about it. You may even try to earn or deserve their money. In our first year on staff, I remember one month where I was particularly unfaithful. I skipped quiet times on purpose. Instead of studying the scriptures in the morning, I watched Sesame Street with my kids on TV. Instead of doing evangelism on campus, I'd sneak over to the dormitory lounge and I watched TV in the dormitory lounge. Then we got our NAV paycheck, and it was the biggest one we'd gotten so far. And I was humbled. People were investing money so I could watch The Price is Right. And I told Elma, I don't see why anyone would want to give to a sloth like me. And she says, I don't either. She said, I think they give to God. That was helpful. Secondly, we tend to look to ourselves as the source of funding. Our own efforts, our own abilities, our own personalities, our own hard work, our own computers. Now, this may come as a shock to some of you, but do you realize that having your own personal computer will not get you up to budget? Sorry to break it to you. Having a sharp presentation book will not get you up to budget. Being outgoing and friendly will not get you up to budget. Putting your picture on your pledge card will not get you up to budget. Merging names on your computer letters will not get you up to budget. Even having a successful ministry will not get you up to budget. Is that what fundraising is all about? Slick presentation, computer merge names, is that the key? Last year, Elma and I sent out a $4,000 cash project mailing. We spent a lot of time and energy on it. In fact, we had the cutest cartoon of the century in that letter. And I got to thinking about it, and I told Elma, I think we're forgetting the Lord. We're depending on that cartoon, and we're depending on that letter rather than the Lord. We need to pray. So let's get our focus on the Lord, not our donors, not our hard work, not our personalities, not our computers. All right, what's the application of all of this? If God is a source, then we need to pray. In our second year on staff, I was worrying and grumbling about our support, and a fellow Iowan, Duane Bunt, who had helped me when I was a young Christian, I appreciated Duane's down-to-earth practicality. So I said, Duane, what are we going to do? He said, well, Scott, do you pray about it? Do you pray about it every day? I said, well, I pray about it, but I don't pray about it every day. He said, well, I think you ought to pray about it. I think you ought to pray about it every day. I said, okay, I'll pray about it. And I began to pray about it every day. And you know, our income went up, and we didn't do one thing differently. God answers prayer. 3 years ago, we prayed that four couples, friends of ours, would begin giving toward our monthly support. And we put a number down beside their name, $50 each month. Now, we could have asked these people for support. In fact, I'm quite sure they would have been responsive. But for one reason or another, we didn't feel right before the Lord to invite them to give. So we prayed. in about a month, one of them called and said, Scott, if I were to give to the Navigators, how would I do it? And so I explained it. He said, now, could I designate that for you? And so next month, $50 showed up in our envelope, and it hasn't missed a month since. A second guy, an older fellow, stuck a check in my pocket one day and said, here, send that in for us. And that turned out to be $50, and they haven't missed since. The third couple pledged at a conference. We were not the offering project. Our needs were not made known. There was nothing said about us at all. And that turned into a $50 pledge that has kept on. But the fourth couple, nothing showed up. So I said, well, Lord, three out of four isn't bad. Appreciate the good work you did. But in December that year, we got a check from them for $600, which divided by 12 equals 50. God answers prayer. He's the source. So I'd encourage you to put by prayer alone as a part of your strategy. Now, these names that you put down for by prayer alone are not people that you're afraid to talk to. The ones you're afraid to talk to, you probably ought to go talk to. But for one reason or another, you don't feel right to invite these people to give. Could you discover three names for by prayer alone? A second belief we must have is that the Bible is the standard for fundraising ethics and practice. Listen to George Mueller's biography. Mr. Mueller was a stickler for obtaining God's gifts in God's way. It is not enough, he says, to obtain means for the work of God. These means should be obtained in God's way. To ask unbelievers for means is not God's way. To press believers to give is not God's way. Our task is not simply to raise our support. Our task is to raise our support in a biblical, God-honoring way. I've heard Rod Sargent say many times, quote, just because a fundraising tactic works doesn't make it right. The following cartoons illustrate a prayer we all should pray. Listen to what this preacher says. Lord, if you disapprove of my money-raising tactics on my TV show, just let me know. Zap. Really, I'm serious. Just let me know. There's a flagrant abuse of fundraising principles today. I have here a direct mail letter from a Christian organization that tells a story about Peter taking the coin out of the fish's mouth. And this writer has included a couple of coins in the letter. The big one you keep for yourself, the small one you send back to him. But as you send it back, you wrap your biggest bill around the coin and return it and rush it back for God's work, he says. Another idea, some of you may want to use this, is a prayer sock. And the writer here suggests that the reader put this prayer sock on overnight, and as prayer requests come to your mind tonight, you get up out of bed and you write these down, and then send those prayer requests back to the preacher along with a $170 gift, a $100 gift, a $70 gift, or a $50 gift, and the slightly used prayer sock. Another trick is some mustard seeds from the Mount of Olives, guaranteed. And you keep one for yourself, and then you send the other back to the preacher with a seed gift of $33, or if you want a double portion of God's love, $66. This is being done. And it's a sham. It's manipulative. Secular fundraisers do this. It's the old two-penny trick. You keep one and send one back to me. That's all this is. It's manipulation. Now, it's not likely that NAV staff are going to start mailing out prayer socks. But I wanted you to be aware of what's going on. 2 Corinthians 4:2 has the phrase, not walking in craftiness. Do we have to be crafty to get our support? In July and August of 1985, through Rod Sargent's leadership, our department had daily prayer for our general fund income. It looked like we would end the fiscal year enormously under budget. Now, the world would have said, even the Christian world might have said, what you need to do is make a desperation plea. Help, we're going under, because that generates more money. But Rod didn't feel we should do that. Instead, we majored on prayer, and we made a very low-key approach. Not at all emotional, not at all pushy. And we received the largest response in the history of the Navigators in any month since our work began. And in August is traditionally a low-income month. Nothing else was done. No other requests were made, and so on. God answers prayer. Well, what can we as a staff do to make sure we don't become crafty or manipulative? I'm amazed at the number of staff who have strong opinions about money or fundraising who have never really done a Bible study on either money or fundraising. I still remember sitting down by the lake in Madison, Wisconsin. I took the book of Proverbs and wrote down every verse that had anything to do with money or possessions. That was extremely helpful. That was life-changing. I think one thing we can do is to be biblical. Don't buy a book on money or don't buy a book on fundraising until you've done your own Bible study, until you've invested 20 or 30 hours in your own study. I believe we have to start there. In your notes is a Bible study on stewardship and on fundraising. That would be a great place to start. Number three, biblical fundraising is a spiritual ministry, not a fleshly effort, reluctantly or apologetically endured. In American Christian culture, money matters are usually considered unspiritual, fleshly, maybe even secular. Discipleship, evangelism, Bible study, conferences, these are spiritual activities. And this diagram shows how we tend to separate the sacred and the secular. Even NAV staff today often view fundraising as the ball and chain holding them back from real ministry. It's a curse rather than a privilege. It's a frustration. In Exodus 35, God told Moses to raise a collection for the tabernacle. And how did Moses respond? Oh, no. Fundraising? I'll do anything but fundraising. I'll lead the people. I'll get the Ten Commandments. I'll judge the people. I'll even eat manna. But I don't want to do fundraising. And for a tent besides. Paul didn't seem to abhor fundraising. Three times he called the collection for the saints in Jerusalem a gracious work. 2 Corinthians 8, 6, 7, and 19. In many churches, when it's time to pass the collection plate, the pastor says, "Let us now worship God through the giving of our tithes and offerings." He does not apologize and say, "I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but we now come to that part of the service where we have to do something fleshly and secular. I'm sorry, but we've got to do it. I hate it. Ushers, please come forward. Let's get this business over with." It helps people lay up treasure in heaven. It helps them live, Matthew 6, 33, seeking first the kingdom. Biblical fundraising gives people opportunities to match their concern. Philippians 4:10, Paul says, "You were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity." People need an opportunity to show their concern. Also, raising support opens doors to further ministry. I found that in talking with people, it takes 20 or 30 minutes to explain the ministry and to do the support raising, and then I've got time to talk with them about how things are going for them. It opens doors for other ministry. So let's change our mind about fundraising being the castor oil of being on the NAV staff. It's a ministry. It's a privilege. Enjoy it. And let's bring it from the secular side over to the sacred side. Number four, receiving biblical support. Receiving support is a biblical right, but does not entitle you to be pushy or demanding. 1 Corinthians 9:14 says, "So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel." We have a right to be supported by the gospel. But Paul adds, "We did not use this right that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel." But you know, I've found it's easy to be pushy without realizing it. I've noticed it's common for Christian workers in making financial appeals to use the statement, "I want you to pray about giving to us." Now, there's no demandingness intended, but that's a command, not an appeal. We NAV staff are used to being in charge. We're kind of used to giving orders, aren't we? I think we need to be careful to make appeals for support rather than demanding that people give to us. Here's another illustration. A NAV alumni who had supported two Navigator staff decided to quit his job and go back to grad school. So he wrote both staff members and said that he was going to be stopping giving and going to grad school. One of the staff members wrote back and commended him on his good giving and wished him well on his new adventure and even gave him a gift. The second staff member wrote back and asked the young man to keep giving because of all the benefit he'd received while he was in the campus ministry. The thought was, at least give something back because of all we've done for you. That wasn't said, but that was the thought. Now this young man is out of grad school. Now he's got a really good job. And now he's only supporting one NAV rep. Can you guess which one? You don't have the right to be pushy or to use leverage to get people to give to you. Strong-arm tactics are not biblical. But you know, I'm afraid that there are people who have come to seminars like this who go away with the idea that they have the right to push pledge cards into people's faces and to pass them out like clowns pass out candy at a circus. It's just not true. Sensitivity, not pushiness. Number five, expect to raise 100% of your negotiated budget. Avoid poor talk. I was talking with one of our staff a few years ago, and we were talking about his NAB budget. You've probably seen that form before. And I noticed he put $30,000 down on line 42, total annual budget, but only $24,000 down on line 43, expected annual income. That's fine. That's what the information asked for. But I asked him why he didn't put $30,000 down as well on line 43. He said, well, why wouldn't he go for 100%? Well, he said, we don't really need $30,000. We can get by on much less. I said, well, if you don't need $30,000, then why'd you put $30,000 down on line 42? Oh, I don't know. He said, I just kind of filled that budget out. You know, I was kind of in a hurry, and I just had to get it done. It's just paperwork anyway. Well, some staff feel that filling out the budget is busy work. And, of course, since most NAB staff only raise about 70% of their budget, all these figures are purely academic anyway. And I confess that I formerly gave lip service to budgets. I filled them out just to get my supervisor off my back sometimes. They had to be done, so I did it. But I didn't pray over them. I didn't give them a lot of thought. They were not a tool that I used or appreciated. But when I started taking fundraising seriously, I saw that I had to take budgeting seriously. I had to change my mind about that. And the issue was stewardship, not fundraising. I used to consider being at 100% of budget a luxury. Part of the problem was that Elma and I never really made a personal household budget. We didn't do any long-range financial planning. Oh, we talked about it, but we never put anything down on paper. We never prayed about it. As a result, we had a get-by mentality. I knew we needed more income, but I wasn't convicted by God to be a good steward. The only thing we knew about stewardship was giving. Well, we have two daughters in college now, and I'm not saying parents ought to put their kids through school. But I certainly wish that I had set aside a little bit each month 15 years ago. It would have made a difference. But saving was a luxury in those days. In fact, in those days, eating was a luxury at times. May I encourage you to take your budget seriously? Don't let the fact that headquarters fills those numbers in as a favor to you distract you from your serious responsibility as a steward. I hope you've taken the time to work out a personal household budget, and that's equally important for singles as well as marrieds. Like all Christians, you are responsible to be a good steward. If you don't have a personal household budget, you'll quit fundraising when you get at 80 or 85%. Husbands, don't guesstimate those line items on the budget. It's about 50 bucks. No, ask your wife what it is. She'll tell you. Wives, make your husbands be specific. You know what it costs to run a house. Single women, does your budget include money set aside for a vacation, for a hobby, for a piece of furniture? Husbands, you need to know that it's your wives that feel the pressure when the income is low. One of our staff was talking with he was being criticized by another NAV staff who they were having lunch together, and the NAV staff and his wife and one of our men in development. And the husband was pontificating on why fundraising was unbiblical, fleshly, and wasn't going to work. And as he was talking, his wife began to weep a little bit. He hardly noticed. And finally, our development man interrupted and said, "Pardon me, may I ask why your wife is weeping?" And this was a very sober time. And she said this. Listen to this. She said, "It's great to live by faith, but I'm the one who has to buy the bread and cheese." Men, let's remember that. All right, here's a question. Jot it down and think about it. How would your ministry be different if you were to be at 100% of budget for the next 12 months? How would your ministry be different if you were to be at 100% of budget for the next 12 months? How would your life be different if you were to be at 100% of budget for the next 12 months? And if you're married, how would your marriage be different if you were to be at budget, 100% of budget for the next 12 months? In your handouts is a worksheet for developing a personal budget. If you don't have one, this would be a good starting place. Another phenomenon that accompanies our view of stewardship is poor talk. What is poor talk? Poor talk is a mentality of wishing there was more money. And it usually is expressed in complaining or hinting. Have you ever participated in a NAV staff pity party? I've been in on some of those. Picture the scene. It's late at night at the regional conference. Two NAV reps have been talking for 3 hours. In that 3-hour period, they have solved every problem the navigators have ever had. And now their talk turns to finances. One says to the other, how's your income doing? Oh, pretty good. We picked up a donor last month for $50. Great. What'd you say his address was? Just kidding. Of course, we lost 17 donors last year. This economy is really hurting us Christian workers. Can't buy gas for the car. No mittens for the kids. I suppose their coats from 3 years ago will still fit. Everything's so expensive these days. They disconnected the phone last week. Can't even call the field director to tell him I can't come to the meeting. That's not so bad. Do you know what our salary check was for last month? $78. We're at 37%. I had to sell my verse pack at a garage sale. That's nothing. Last month I didn't get a check at all. Headquarters sent me a bill. I owe them something. I tell you, these are the last days. You know what the problem is? It's all those deductions at headquarters. Pension, ESA, WC, taxes. Wonder what they do with our money. It's all Annette's fault at staff accounting. Let's call her right now and find out what she's doing with our money. There are all kinds of poor talk, and we've been involved in things like that. A NAV administrator once called the budgets in a memo a wish list. Of course, we all knew what he meant, didn't we? An author who advises new missionaries made this revealing comment. Lois and I almost did not come to the mission field because of fundraising. We could not bring ourselves to beg for our support. Is that what fundraising is all about? Begging? Saturday Review magazine in 1978 made this comment on poor talk. Although poor talk is understandable, it is nevertheless debilitating. First, it makes us feel worse about our plight than is necessary. Second, poor talk focuses our attention on ourselves, blinding us to the needs of others. Now, why do Christian workers talk poor? We all do it from time to time. Here's what the staff have told me over the last 3 years. A, it's a form of self-pity, feeling sorry for myself in public. B, it just seems more spiritual. Poverty and spirituality go hand in hand. C, and this is a good one, it's often a disguised financial appeal. We think maybe people will catch on to the fact that we need more money if we drop a subtle hint or something. And this is common. I wonder if we even do it subconsciously. It's actually manipulation. D, I wonder if sometimes it's just a bad habit, and we've just gotten ourselves into a bad habit. Now, what does poor talk communicate to our constituency? Well, it communicates sympathy. They may feel sorry for us. But secondly, it communicates that we're having a financial struggle. And our donors wonder if the hand of God is really on us if we're struggling year after year after year. Your donors don't like it when they see you struggle financially year after year after year. It makes them ask questions. Instead of drawing donors to us, poor talk scares them away. It's counterproductive. I asked a friend who supports many NAV staff how she felt about NAV staff who hint about their finances. Here's what she said. It makes me feel bad, but I'm probably not going to do anything about it. What does the Bible say? Philippians 4, verses 11 to 13. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Contentment is the point. In 1968, we were in dire financial straits in Missouri, and I didn't mind complaining about it either. I just wanted to let a few people know, and the staff there in Missouri told me, Scott, you may be poor, but don't talk like you're poor. That was helpful. In the early days of the Navigators, whenever any of the staff missed a meal because of inadequate income, Dawson Trotman would tell them to put a toothpick in their mouth anyway. Be content. I like that. Luke 10, verses 4 and 7. Jesus told the disciples not to take a bag, and in the margin of the New American Standard it says, beggar's bag. And he told them in verse 7 not to move from house to house. Beggars usually have a bag and they have an itinerary. They move from house to house. Clearly, Jesus Christ did not want his laborers to have the mentality of begging. A.W. Tozer said, not referring to money but simply to God's blessing, you can have as little as you are satisfied with or as much as God wants to give you. Elma and I have made three commitments regarding this matter of poor talk, and not every staff needs to make these, but they've been helpful to us. First of all, no joking or hinting about money that shows that we want more of it. No joking or hinting about money that shows that we want more of it. We believe that God will provide, and we're not even allowed to poor talk to one another. We don't ask people to pray for our finances. If we want them to give, we ask them to give. Secondly, no griping about high prices. One day, Elma came home from the grocery store, and we began going through the sacks, complaining about the high cost of string beans, soap, paper towels, whatever else was in the bag, and we severely criticized the U.S. economy and whoever was president during that time. Then we caught ourselves, what are we doing? Will God provide for us? Are prices too high? Of course prices are too high. That's not the issue. We need to be frugal, but God will provide. And the third commitment we've made is we've decided we may not compare ourselves with other staff or with other Christian workers. Sometimes inner battles rage in our mind when we see the good fortune of other Christian workers. Wow, they sure have nice furniture. Wonder when we're going to get a new sofa. 2 Corinthians 10:12 says, when they measure themselves by themselves, they are without understanding. What if your donors find out that you're at 100% of budget? Won't they stop giving? They will be delighted. They will also be surprised. If you have to keep reminding people that you're below budget in order to keep them giving to you, that's manipulation. One of our donors said, well, Scott, since you're up to budget, guess we won't have to give to you anymore, right? I said, well, if you were to stop giving to us, we wouldn't be up to budget, would we? Ah, good point, he says. Your donors will be delighted when they find out you're at 100% of budget. They'll love it. Number 6, focus on the giver, not his money. Proverbs 19:6 says, many will entreat the favor of a generous man, and every man is a friend to him who gives gifts. Our radar goes up when we meet someone who's known to be wealthy and generous. Staff who are normally low-key, shy, or introverted suddenly become warm, effusive, spontaneous. They could get a job as a quizmaster on a daytime TV show. But Philippians 4:17 says, not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek for the profit which increases to your account. We're not to focus on the person's money. We're to focus on the person. The person is more important than his money. In 1979, I called an old friend to invite him to join our support team. He was the first fruit of our ministry back in Iowa City in 1970. He had given to us for several years, but then we'd lost contact. As I dialed the phone, I prayed that God would lead me in saying what was right. But I had the distinct impression, a bit subjective, but the distinct impression I should not ask him to give to us during that day. So we talked a bit on the phone, had some fellowship, got caught up, and had a very pleasant 30-minute visit. 6 months later, I called him up and came right to the point and invited him to join our team for $50 a month, which he gladly did. He probably would have been responsive the time before, but I didn't feel the Lord was leading me. And I'd encourage you to be sensitive in that way too. Not out of fear. I didn't hesitate to bring it up with Tom because I was afraid. That was not the issue. It was a sensitivity to the leading of the Lord. How do we keep our motivation clear? For example, a wealthy person comes into your circle of friends. You're tempted to pander to him. You're tempted to put a beginning with Christ in his front pocket and take his wallet out of his back pocket. That thought crosses your mind. Here's a couple suggestions. Number one, admit that the temptation is there. Greed, avarice, manipulation. You've got them all. Don't deny it. First, we have to confess this temptation. Confess that this thing is a temptation to us. Secondly, make a decision to do what is right for that individual, whether you get any money or not. Make a decision to do what is right for that individual, whether you get any money or not. I pray, Lord, I'd love for these people to give, but I want what's best for them even more. That's a lordship issue. I have a poem that helps me as I walk up to a prospective giver's house. I put my hand upon the door. I quote Philippians 2, 3, and 4. That helps me. Number 3, determine not to hint. People can pick up your signals, and instead of drawing them to you, it makes them suspicious. By the way, when will your motivation ever be 100% perfect? Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? If you're waiting around until your motivation gets 100% perfect before you do fundraising, you'll never get started. Number 7. Emphasize the greatness of your vision, not the greatness of your need. How did Paul do it? Let's turn to Romans chapter 15. In Romans 15, we see Paul's vision. Then we see the basis for his vision. And then we see his appeal for help. Romans 15, verses 20 to 24. And thus I aspired to preach the gospel, not where Christ was already named, that I might not build upon another man's foundation. This is Paul's dazzling vision. This is the first point of his outline. And it's an exciting vision, to preach where Christ has not been named. That would be a great motto for a Christian organization. Now, when I say dazzling vision, I'm not referring to hype or sensationalism or something like that. I'm referring to a genuine enthusiasm and zeal that you have to accomplish the calling God has given you. That's what I mean by dazzling vision. Now, in verse 21, we see the basis for Paul's vision. They who had no news of him shall see, and they who have not heard shall understand. Taken from Isaiah 52. A scriptural basis, or a promise for our vision, is very helpful. It keeps us on track, and it gives us encouragement. Now in verse 24, we see how Paul invites others to help him. For I hope to see you in passing, and to be helped on my way there by you. This is an appeal. So Paul states his dazzling vision. He identifies the thing that undergirds it, and then he asks them to help on his way to Spain to accomplish his vision. Now, Paul is not merely asking for warm, fuzzy encouragement here. He's not merely asking for somebody to accompany him along the way for part of the journey, which is the custom in those countries. The Greek word is propempo, and it means practical assistance. It would at least mean outfitting with what he needed for at least one more day's journey. It's indirect in our culture, but in that culture it would have been clearly understood. Paul is asking for assistance. Let's not go to people just with a need. Let's go to people with our dazzling vision. And then let's explain to them why we have this vision. And then let's invite them to join us. Don't get that outline mixed up. People want to give to a work that is going somewhere, and the vision must precede the need. Your ministry doesn't have to be big, it doesn't have to be spectacular, but it has to have God's fingerprints all over it. I've even stopped using the word need in my presentations. Too often we emphasize our dire economic woes rather than our dazzling vision. In a Peanuts cartoon, we see Linus sitting in a beanbag chair staring at a TV set. In the second frame, the TV announcer says, "This program needs your support." In the third frame, the TV announcer says, "We need your donations." And Linus is still sitting there staring at the TV. In the fourth frame, the announcer pleads, "If we don't hear from you, we'll have to go off the air." And in the final frame, Linus finally speaks. He says, "So long." Invite people to give to the most exciting work of God on planet Earth, your ministry. Now, just explaining the NAV ministry is not enough. What is your ministry in the NAV context? The NAV organization is the background. You are center stage. A couple from another organization called on us to raise support. That was fine. We knew why they were coming. And they went through a presentation, but they didn't say anything about themselves. It was all what the organization was doing overseas. No personal testimony, no personal war stories, no personal pictures. It was all institutional and kind of dull. We didn't find out about the couple. We didn't know what made them tick, what their vision was. In giving presentations, remember that your fundraising presentation book or your slideshow, whatever tool you're using, is only a tool. It's only a framework upon which you hang your dazzling vision. Make it breathe by filling in war stories, personal pictures, personal illustrations. By the way, you can never explain the NAB ministry anyway, right? But you can illustrate it. And let me encourage you to do that. Now, one staff told me that he'd had limited success in fundraising. He said, "Scott, do you think maybe that I've got a tendency to be a little too low-key and when I talk?" And I said, maybe he did. And there's got to be some genuine enthusiasm there. You can't change your personality, but you must be zealous no matter what personality type you have. Now, I'm not talking about hype. I'm not suggesting we all go out and buy plaid sport coats and try to imitate used car salesmen. I'm not suggesting that. But there has to be a genuine enthusiasm, a genuine zeal, no matter what your personality type. Well, what's your dazzling vision? Have you thought about that? What is your vision that, is it contagious? Do other people like it? Is it catching? Are you excited about it? And have you fitted into, have you been able to explain it in a way that makes sense to other people? Well, we've discussed seven essential attitudes and beliefs. Ask the Lord to show you how you can even improve on your attitudes as you go about raising your personal support.